This is 1A. I'm Jen White. With new music available to us for free with just a click of a button, it's easy to imagine that album reviews are a relic of the past. That is, unless you're one of the 2.3 million people who subscribe to the YouTube channel The Needle Drop. It's the creation of music critic Anthony Fantano. He's been reviewing albums on camera for over a decade now. His videos sound like this.
Hey, 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 everyone. Anthony Fantano here. Hi, everyone. Winthony Swept Tano here. Elonthony Musk Tano here, the internet's busiest music nerd, and it's time for a review. This DJ Khaled album, it's not good. This new Blink 182 record, it's not good.
2020 vision.
Who that boy? Who him is? Who that boy?
I'm just surprised at how many moments on this record cemented themselves in my head, even after just a few listens of the album.
The more I began to listen to this album, the more the emotion of it, the sadness of it, began to hit me like a Mack truck.
Gotcha.
Find some time to do something.
I would not listen with a fox. I would not listen in a box. I would not listen in the rain. I would not listen on a train.
Fantano calls himself the internet's busiest music nerd, but he made some time to talk with us from his home in Connecticut. Anthony, welcome to 1A.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so this is public radio, so I have to start with a public radio question. You interned at your local NPR station after college, where you wrote about music and created a podcast that ended up being a sort of prototype for your YouTube channel, The Needle Drop. Talk about those early days of getting into music criticism.
Yeah, it was around 2007 that I started interning at this station. I got a connection from the journalism department at my college and had shadowed some reporters and did Vox Pop and produced some stuff behind the scenes and was in the studio a lot and really just trying to learn more of the ropes past the years that I spent in college radio prior to that. And after a while, I sort of started to miss all the music-based programming that I would always hear at the college station and would do at the college station. And after the station sort of switched from a classical format to a news talk format, after some encouragement, I guess, from a producer, George Goodrich, who I worked with there at the time, I just decided to try to make a music show, just try to do a show, just kind of analyzing new albums coming out, talking about what was so great about them, and just trying to present it in as straightforward a way as possible. The general manager liked it, despite when I go back and I listen to some of those shows, I think they were kind of bad. But, you know, they were repeating a lot of programming throughout the day, and I think they could have maybe use something, you know, to kind of break things up. And after sort of doing it as a podcast on their site for a while, you know, they allowed it on air and it was airing on Saturday nights for quite a long time. And yeah, that's really kind of where it all began in a way.
Well, you've been reviewing music on camera for over a decade now. What was the process like of taking the traditional album review and reimagining it for a new format and a new audience?
It was really simple and obvious to me at the time, but also kind of ironic and stressing in a way, because throughout college and throughout the time I had spent at NPR and just all the time I spent in college radio, I mean, my mind and my heart and my passion was really just like in radio. That's where I was. That's where I wanted to be. That's what I wanted to do. That's where I sort of imagined myself landing at the end of the day. But simultaneously, I was, you know, someone who was on the internet a lot, someone who was on YouTube a lot, someone who watched vloggers and people go on camera and talk about their favorite video games or politics or something like that. And it's sort of after doing a long think about it and spending really well over a year doing the podcast, running a music blog as well, and not seeing it sort of make the kind of headway that I wanted it to, it just seemed clear to me that I needed to change up formats and do something different. And considering all the content I was already consuming that was, you know, in kind of a video style, it just seemed clear to me to do that. Now, the ironic part of that was that, you know, I had taken some I guess on-camera, you know, journalism courses in college, and I don't know. I mean, I was a pretty decent student in school, but I did horrible in those classes. And I swore after those classes I would never touch a camera again. And now I touch a camera every day of my life.
I want to play a clip from one of your videos. Here's your review of Justin Bieber's 2020 album, Changes.
I've been dreading doing this video, worried I wouldn't end up liking this album because hating Justin Bieber is so cliche at this point. Who wants to be the 1 billionth guy saying, ugh, Justin Bieber bad, Justin Bieber sucks, I don't like Justin Bieber, no good Justin Bieber, no good. I also respect majorly the fact that the guy was able to go from kid music star to an adult while holding on to his career, holding on to his relevancy, which is incredibly rare.
How did you develop your YouTube aesthetic? Because for people who aren't familiar, your videos are intentionally a little chaotic, a little ranty. Your reviews are infused with a lot of histories and facts about the industry. You throw in some sociopolitical context. There's a whole fashion aspect to it that comes into play as well. But how did you come up with what you wanted these videos to look and feel like?
Yeah, it's just kind of a... It's something that's really slowly developed over time. Some of the ideas, I wish I had had them earlier, you know, so that when I go back and I look at a video from like 2011 or 2012, like it's more consistent, I guess. I'm a kind of a big nitpicker for consistency, at least in my own personal life and my work. But as you say, there is almost like a fashion aspect to it because, you know, YouTube... It's a really kind of rudimentary way that they get people to click on or sort of just introduce people to videos. But, you know, you're basically working with titles and with thumbnails. And as far as the thumbnail goes, all I can really present the audience is like a picture of me and a image of the album that I'm reviewing, and can't really signal much else to them unless I'm to, you know, to busy up the thumbnail with like text or something like that. So I figured like one of the most simple ways I could go about that was just wearing a certain colored shirt and, you know, to show people, hey, this is a really positive review, or hey, this is a really negative review, or, you know, maybe wearing something just more neutral if it's something in the middle. And that came as, I guess, sort of an insinuation from a random commenter saying that, hey, you wear that yellow flannel whenever you like an album, which, I mean, I could think of dozens of times I had worn it and, you know, it was a negative review or like, you know, a middling review or something like that. But it sort of dawned on me, well, what if that was the case? And I sort of started just kind of playing into that presumption. As far as other aspects of the video go, yeah, I try to keep it conversational. You know, I mean, it's really kind of a up to the viewer's interpretation at the end of the day. I mean, there are a lot of people that see what I do and read it as really pretentious, or maybe I'm using a lot of $5 words or something like that. But I do try to consciously keep it as simple as possible and, you know, talk on camera as if I guess maybe I had like a small crowd of 100 people in front of me, and maybe I was doing like a TEDx or like a report or something on whatever it is I'm trying to review or talk about. And another core belief of mine in terms of speaking or delivering anything is that I feel like most things go down better with humor, especially if I'm having to... you know, maybe give out a review that is maybe not as positive. And that's not to say that I'm trying to sort of like bully the artist per se, or sort of like turn them purely into the butt of the joke or whatever. But if I can, you know, maybe make a somewhat funny observation, or maybe indulge in some self-deprecation or something, or just, you know, throw in a quip or a side joke here and there.
How welcomed have you felt by the old guard of music critics writing for print? Does it matter what they think?
I think it matters sort of what they think. I mean, I think in the age of democratized opinions, in a way, it sort of matters what everybody thinks. I mean, I think that's sort of the beauty of the modern age. I don't think I would be where I am without that. You know, that was kind of what I was met with originally when I had seen maybe on the internet people who were professional critics coming across my work and thinking it was trash or silly or garbage or whatever. But, you know, it's merely by virtue of the fact that everybody kind of gets a say now that, you know, that I'm able to do what I do. And, you know, and that's not, again, to say that I think that people from that generation or who are cut from that cloth or come from that leg of the industry have, you know, less importance. It's just that everybody else's importance has kind of been leveled up in a way.
Well, we got some questions from your very devoted fan base, including this one from Jesse, who asks, I followed Anthony's channel for 6 years, and he's introduced me to countless artists. How does he decide which albums get reviewed? He always has a good mix of upcoming artists as well as big names. What's your response to Jesse?
Yeah, it's really just kind of a mix. Personally, I try to balance out the demands of my audience with also just my own personal sanity and just getting at least some kind of enjoyment out of what I do as well, and just the process of searching for and listening to new music. I mean, I think every week there are at least a couple of releases that if I did not review them, or if I ignore them, or if I had glossed over them in some way, my audience would kill me. So I make sure to cover those, talk about those, you know, regardless of, I guess, my own personal level of interest. You know, I try to give it the old college try, and sometimes I actually end up surprised and enjoying some of those more mainstream or more obvious releases than I thought I would going into it. And then just for my own personal enjoyment, I just really kind of get the most out of what I do when I'm coming across an artist or a sound or a record that I was never aware of prior, and I'm totally stumbling upon for the first time, and I love it. And I'm seeing that there maybe aren't too many people who are into it as well or aware of it, and then I get the privilege of going onto YouTube where I can potentially reach hundreds of thousands of people and say, hey, you know, point your ears in this direction because this is pretty fantastic. I mean, I know that if a Drake album comes out tomorrow, I've got to review that because that's going to help pay the bills and everything. But I don't think the fact that I have a Drake opinion, just like dozens of other people have Drake opinions, is kind of the glue holding at least the little community that I have, together on.
Yeah, because reviewing new albums is only part of what you do. You also recap music award shows. You make videos about artists' entire discographies. You interview musicians. You also have these videos where you talk about albums you've changed your mind about. One was about Kanye West's 2010 album, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy. You didn't love that one the first time around, and you got some criticism from your fans about it. But here's a clip from your Redux review of that album from earlier this year.
This YouTube channel recently hit 2 million subscribers, and in a weird way, I thought this would be a fun way to celebrate that. And finally, it's now been about 10 years since this LP originally came out. Over that span of time, I've come to hold quite a bit of respect for the place this album holds in Kanye's discography. A creative bounce back from one of the most tumultuous periods in his life. A major second wind to his career. And a gateway to the more manic and unpredictable side of his discography.
How much do you feel it's your duty as a music critic to give an album you didn't love a second listen, even if it's years or decades after the fact?
I think it's just an important part of, I think, my own personal narrative and philosophy around reviewing music. There are some things that I feel like I'm having to constantly remind people of, and I think it's a good thing to remind people of, like, hey, at the end of the day, this is all just my opinion. You don't have to agree with it. It's not gospel. You know, once you've reached a point where your experience and your point of view has changed as a result of time passing, having heard new things, gone through different things through your life, different albums and different artists may mean different things to you. And it provides another, I guess, interesting conversation, to have with my audience, because it's not something that critics often talk about, changing your mind on something that you reviewed years ago. And, I personally am happy with, some of the calls that I've made over the years. But I think it's also important to be able to, you know, be able to accept when your mind has changed or maybe something has grown on you or maybe even something is not as great as you thought it was. Because sometimes when I'm talking about my mind changing, it's that, you know, sometimes the problem is I've hyped something up a little too much. And, you know, maybe over the years has kind of grown, you know, a little gray for me and it doesn't really stand out as much.
Well, when you're sitting down to review an album, you know, I think about when I listen to an album for the first time, there's, you know, the technical work that goes into the album. You know, there's the artistry, and then there's the way it makes me feel. What are you listening for when you sit down to review an album?
You know, I'm definitely listening for those technical elements, at least from a production side, because I feel like that's almost like the subconscious of the music in a way that maybe not a lot of people, your average listener necessarily is like diving into. And that's, you know, I guess trying to analyze like why does the guitar sound that way, or why are the vocals mic'd in the way that they are, or, you know, why is there a certain amount of reverb on a certain piece of instrumentation, and why is, you know, it mixed or EQ'd in the way that it is, and like what does that convey, like, you know, what is the balance of all of these sounds, like what's the assembly essentially that's happening here. I try to make note of that. And beyond that, you know, the feelings are really important in the review for me anyway, because that's going to be the easiest and the fastest way to relate to whoever it is that's watching the video, because not everybody who reads or listens to or watches a music review is a musician or a production nut or anything like that. Sometimes they're not picking up on these things, and all they're really interested in at the end of the day is you know, how's this music going to make me feel? How am I going to feel listening to it? How does the music feel emotionally? And you know, in that regard, it's important to point out whether or not what's being listened to, is it kind of surreal or psychedelic or quaint or, I guess, really intimate or introspective? Is it aggressive and visceral and cathartic? Is it, I mean, a whole host of other things. There are lots of kind of emotional or, I guess, feeling type descriptors that you could throw onto a piece of music. And that's certainly important to point out too, so that you kind of give the viewer a heads up as to what they're about to get into.
We're airing our conversation with music critic Anthony Fantano. His YouTube channel is called The Needle Drop. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from our guest in a moment. Back now to our conversation with music critic Anthony Fantano. He's been reviewing music on camera for over a decade, and he's amassed quite a following. His YouTube channel, called The Needle Drop, has over 2 million subscribers. So you're a music critic, and that's a role that can be very polarizing. You're doing this work on social media, so YouTube. You have followers on Twitch, on TikTok. And we're in this time where people are not exactly polite on social media. There's a lot of feedback. You're in constant conversation with folks just through the comments section. To what extent does disagreement seep into how you think about music criticism? Because you get that immediate feedback when you post something. People let you know how they feel about what you've said immediately in the comments.
Yeah, I mean, I think the instant feedback doesn't really impact my feelings on music criticism per se. I mean, you know, the thoughts of my audience definitely plays a role in how I might perceive certain songs or albums, but that's really only usually after the fact, maybe after I've gotten some distance between me and the record and maybe whoever is still thinking about the album at that point, because most of these conversations really only last like 2 weeks at the most post the release of a record, you know, because of how quickly everything's cycling these days. I mean, a lot of the time, whatever the mosh pit of, you know, discourse that's going on post the release of an album is not really I guess, super nuanced and detailed much of the time. It's really only after the fact that if you have people who are still listening to it and still thinking about it and still peeling back the layers of whatever the album is, because it's maintained their attention for that long, that's when you usually kind of get some gems and some more thoughtful discussion. And a lot of the discourse in that initial sort of leg, especially if a lot of people are like passionate about the record and it's new and they're not used to it yet and they're just excited by the fact that it's out and they're just loving every moment of it without having heard enough of it to really kind of like formulate maybe a nuanced opinion on it, they'll lash out and be angry in response to any kind of, you know, perceived criticism or, you know, slight against the record or the artist. And again, I think it's kind of important to not dive too deeply into that noise or take it too seriously or take it too personally, I suppose.
So again, you're doing this work on social media, and as you said, we're in this time when everyone doesn't just have an opinion, but they have a place where they can share that opinion. How do you think that's changed gatekeeping in the music industry, both in terms of criticism and in what music gets made?
Yeah, I think it's kind of changed gatekeeping for the better, or it's made gatekeeping less of a thing. It's kind of a mix. While I feel like this old kind of gatekeeping that we're used to is dying off and not as relevant and not as much of a threat, and I think that's fantastic. I think that's ultimately a good thing. The other kind of gatekeeping, though, that I'm seeing kind of rise up and become more of a thing is this gatekeeping that I think people aren't really aware of, because it's not coming necessarily at the end of, somebody's opinion or somebody's pen or, you know, some, editorial director's, you know, decision in a boardroom. You know, it's coming as a result of these algorithmic decisions that are being made on streaming platforms. And as people become more and more dependent on these platforms as a form of music introduction, whatever it is algorithmically they're deciding to platform or share or push onto people is becoming more and more, you know, relevant, or more and more, I guess, the status quo. I mean, I think at the end of the day, like, we're still coming out ahead as far as I could see so far, because, the internet still does provide such incredible freedom and, I guess, variety that you just didn't really have before, when you were kind of going back to the days of just like print media and radio and MTV kind of being those key factors and kind of avenues through which you'd be hearing about a lot of this stuff. But, still, I do kind of wonder about and worry about people unconsciously being almost like herded into these different pipelines in the online world and sort of ending up in these equally isolating music bubbles where they're only being recommended things that these platforms already kind of know that they will enjoy, and there's nothing really kind of like pushing them outside of their comfort zone and urging them to try something different and try something new and really just like, kind of like break through the matrix, as it were, and get into jazz, get into psychedelic folk, get into power electronics, get into industrial hip hop, get into a whole myriad of other things that aren't necessarily like the most algorithmically profitable genres and styles out there. You know, there's a whole world of music out there, and I hate to see it being limited in any way, shape, or form. But, I worry about that kind of gatekeeping. But overall, I think the average young music listener today is adventurous, is open. I see a lot of people who follow me, and, you know, they're just as interested in my thoughts on this new death metal record as they are on my thoughts on the new Lady Gaga record. Hmm. Whereas, like, when I was a kid listening to music, or when I was even in college and, you know, was the music director at the station that I was working at, that was not quite a thing. You know, the hip-hop kids weren't listening to what the indie kids were listening to, and the indie kids weren't listening to what the metalhead kids were listening to, and so on and so forth. But now it's really all just kind of, like, blending into this borderless soup, and I think culturally it's for the better.
Well, I want to quickly get through a few more questions. Ethan tweets, I've been a longtime viewer of The Melon. I love his content. That's their name for you. He's introduced me to many quality artists. My main question is, how often have his fans and followers exposed him to new artists that he ends up reviewing highly?
Yeah, all the time. It happens all the time. I think that's an integral part of, you know, just my process, kind of going back to the question that you asked earlier about how I, you know, decide what to review. You know, another key part of that is just the ongoing, you know, conversation and suggestions from my audience, because, yeah, they do often push on to me, like, we need you to, you know, review this because it's, you know, part of this grander conversation and it's really popular and a lot of us are listening to it, yes. But a lot of much more obscure, you know, recommendations come in the midst of all of that too. And while I'm just one person and I cannot listen to everything as hard as I try, you know, I will do my best anytime that I can. If somebody makes a compelling case for something, or if somebody throws something in front of my face that seems kind of interesting based off of genre descriptors, title, album art, I mean, you know, really, I mean, really the same things that might attract you or anybody else to an album who might be listening. Somebody just throws something random in front of my face, I mean, it's really just a click away, no reason not to just give it a quick try if I have a few minutes to spare. That's literally what I'm online to do anyway. So,
well, Danny Dorito also wants to know if you've ever thought of reviewing movie scores and soundtracks, because that's a recurring segment he'd really like to see.
Yeah, that's something that I've done occasionally here and there and toyed with and thought a lot about. And it's not something that personally interests me as much as just kind of just reviewing just straight recording artists. I mean, as fantastic as many music and as fantastic as many movie scores are out there, you know, I've certainly given quite a few their due if they deserve it. You know, I really see, like, movie scores conceptually as being, like, very complementary to you know, the visual aspects of the film, and I don't sometimes get as much gratification out of listening to them on their own as I, you know, enjoy them kind of in context with the film that it is they're working with. I feel like that sort of makes analyzation difficult as well, because, you know, if there are ways in which the soundtrack or aspects of it end up lacking, I mean, that may just be because it, you know, wasn't meant purely to just be listened to in kind of a solo fashion. It's kind of a complementary piece, you know? So, you know, if I am to sort of judge it on the same merits that I am, you know, other albums that I'm reviewing, it wouldn't quite make as much sense, but at least in my own view. But, you know, I understand and I sort of sympathize with those calls and those requests, but it's I guess it's just not something that I've been able to kind of personally work out in a way where I feel okay with it. Mm.
Well, I would love for you to walk us through some of your favorite new albums of 2020.
Yeah, I mean, some highlights for me personally. I mean, I was just really listening to and finishing up a review of this Japanese folk artist whose name is Achiko Aoba. And it's just a really serene, beautiful folk album loaded with these ornate bits of string and piano, and the vocals are really gentle as well. It's got this stunning stillness to it that's pretty captivating. There's also the new Jesse Ware record, which I think is the best dance album I've heard in a long time. really kind of throwing it back to all these elements of disco and funk and synth pop. I mean, it's really just a menagerie of sounds and vibes from the 1970s to the 1980s, but they all kind of coalesce into this singular kind of anachronistic sound that seems to just embody all of it at once. That record is absolutely stellar. Really euphoric too. The new Clipping album is the second of two that they've dropped within a year of each other. Frontman for that group, David Diggs, many of your listeners may be familiar with because, played in Hamilton and is, you know, just a really formidable and creative rapper himself. The two guys that he works with are experimental and noise musicians, and they come together with this really adventurous brand of hip-hop that really nobody else out there is doing right now. And as I said, this is kind of a sequel or a sister album to a record they dropped last year around the same time, around Halloween, and both are horror-themed and deeply influenced by horror film and horror, you know, based aesthetics. So, I mean, if you're in the mood for something creative and also spooky, you could certainly give that new album from them a try as well. Visions of bodies being burned. Candlesticks in
the dark. Visions of bodies being burned. The hook gon' be what it is, the hands off. The retribution for what you took from the man. Got blood on the rust. God bless the red earth. The dead man walks the tongue bridge. A bridge, the time space, the boot, the concrete. The project undone, they juke it. Major look, you can't see it. The mob built the walls, the streets it bleeds sweet syrup, the bees love it. They coming on a swarm and they raining on your college.
Also really enamored with the newest record from singer-songwriter Laura Marling. She's been doing her thing in the UK for quite a while, and I think this new record of hers is some of the most simple and beautiful, gorgeous, sincere, and frank songwriting that I've heard in quite a while.
I woke up, it was 4 in the morning, clear as all hell that you'd already gone. No, it's that dear, you know I hate to disappear, but the days are short and the nights are getting long.
But yeah, you know, there are a lot of highlights throughout the year. You know, I feel like even though it's been a bit of a strange year for music and musicians, just considering the shutdown of the live sector as a result of the pandemic and everything, it hasn't necessarily led to a lack of compelling projects. You know, there's been a lot of great records out there, even some that are literally in response to the pandemic and the lockdowns and the isolation, like the new Charlie XCX album, for example. I mean, whose themes pretty much dive into at least the first and initial kind of feelings of the isolation, dealing with the lockdown.
Love, suicide, you and I drove for miles. No one be here, be here, be here with you. No one be here, be here, be here with you. We took a dive in the blue, scared to lose.
I mean, thankfully there's been music out there to talk about. You know, I feel very blessed that artists have continued to do what they do best through all of this, even though I know it's been hard on everybody, especially, you know, people in the music industry with, again, like that most profitable element for artists being closed off to them completely.
That's music critic Anthony Fantano. His YouTube channel is called The Needle Drop. Anthony, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on.
A reminder that we're on Instagram. You can find us at The 1A Show. Today's producer was Catherine Fink. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk more soon. This is 1A.